Well, I'm a desert child from a border town where they set you up just to knock.
Hello, and welcome to the How I Got That Way podcast. I am your host, Brandon Doble. Today with me is a very funny guy, Professor Sam Negus. Sam is a PhD in history. He is a teacher, a well-rounded, well-read man. He is also a complete fanatic when it comes to the Derby County Rams. Sam was raised in Derby County, England, and he came of age during the hooligan era of English football. Sam is also the co-host of another podcast that I do, which is launching next week, called Football in Football, which we talk about our two great passions, college football and European football. Sam adds an incredible insight to what it was like growing up in England during the tumultuous 80s and 90s and falling in love with college football when he came here for grad school. So today we're going to talk to Sam about what that was like, how he became a college football fan, and how he became a true Derby County Ram. So welcome to the show, Sam. Good to have you. I don't even know. What town are you actually from, Sam? What's the name of the village?
Stapleford.
Stapleford. So if for our English fans out there, they'll know exactly where that metropolis is.
It's unlikely. It's semi obscure, but it is old, so that's good. Listed in the Doomsday Book, so there you go.
Look at you.
My village has been there 1,000 years.
Wow. Has your house that you grew up in been there 1,000 years?
No, it hasn't. But my dad did dig up what he's quite sure is a Stone Age tool when he was doing gardening the other day. He dug up a Stone Age scraper and turned it into the archaeology department of Nottingham University. So,
oh wow, look at that!
People have been digging stuff up in my front yard for a long ass time.
Well, we just here in the States, as you know, we just dig up Indian graveyards. So, you know, that's how we do our, that's how ancient ours is. I was always amazed when I went to Italy and I would go there every summer, at, like the houses would be 800 years old and they couldn't tear them down because of, I don't know, some sort of historical thing. But it was just crazy that they were older than our country by like times 10. Yep. So anyway, so you are from Stapleford, UK. I'm sure I'm butchering that. I'm sure there's a better English way to say it. I am from Cloverdale, California, a small village that is not at all old and not at all interesting and with very few Stone Age tools being dug up, but nonetheless, an important village in the wine country of California. So, Sam, we talked about doing this show together because we discovered that we both had a passion for two sports. One was college football. And the other was European or world football, and specifically for me, the Premiership, and for you, your beloved Derby County Rams. Is that correct?
That's right, which one of these years may also overlap with a love of the Premiership, but it has an annual way of not quite happening at the moment. So
hope springs eternal. Well, if it can happen for Leeds United, it can happen for Derby County. All right. So as we launch into this, I want to talk about a little bit about the concept of this show and why we're doing it. We were talking one day, and you were mentioning how you follow Derby County, and I'd heard of them because I have this poster of all the professional English football clubs. So I was cursorily aware of them. But you were talking about the famous, world famous Derby County, is it Nottingham Forest rivalry?
Yeah.
And the hated rival. And I was privileged enough to sit down and watch a game with you where in the very last dying embers of the game, I believe that Derby County tied the game, which was a huge success for those American football fans. They can't truly appreciate the joy that is the tie at times.
The sheer sublimity of relief of not losing. You have to qualify by saying you were not privileged to watch the entire game. You were privileged to watch the last 30 seconds of a game that for 97 preceding minutes had been just an excruciating insult to all that is sportsmanship, athleticism, human prowess, in the realm of physical achievement had been, in a word, dire.
It had, I don't know if I would have quite put it that way, but that sort of sums up where we are and why the fan.
Yeah, and worse than dire, not just dire football, which is an insult to the beautiful game in the abstract, but the worst kind of dire football, which is a match in which Nottingham Forest are better than Derby County, which is scientifically the worst form of football. By the same measure, if Derby County bests Nottingham Forest in a match in which nothing of any interest happens, that qualifies as truly legendary, memorable quality football.
Absolutely, and so let's explain that to our listeners, because many people aren't going to quite understand the idea. You had said to me, and I love this because it's exactly how I feel about my beloved Oregon Ducks. You said watching Derby County is not fun. It is so, and I don't want to. I think you do a better job of summing it up. But let's say Derby County is playing in an important game. What is match week like leading up to the game, the game itself, and whether you win or lose? What's that experience like you as the true Derby County fan?
Well, leading up to the game, I mean, this week has been, I suppose, a typical start of the season week. Basically, every break I get from work, I'm on my phone refreshing the news feed to see whether we've finalized the signing of the player that we've been chasing this week. And even though I know full well that there won't be any updates, I'm going to check anyway, which is a complete waste of time, cellular data that has been routed to me via a satellite in space, which of all the human scientific and technological achievement that has gone into global communication, here's a pathetic person like me checking whether Derby County has finalized the signing of a 22-year-old Polish winger who's probably going to turn out to be rubbish. We could be using this to read the works of Cicero in PDF for free or some other wonderful thing, but I'm going to use it to go on Google and see whether or not Derby have signed a new player so they can continue being overly expensive also mediocre, hoping somehow that the starting lineup is going to be more tantalizing, have greater potential than it had last week. And then, after about 3.5 minutes into the match, it'll be clear that the answer to all of those questions is no, for about the 5,000th consecutive time in my life to date. We're just going to watch more of the same tepid lateral or backwards ball shoving until inevitably someone makes a mistake that decides the match, probably us, possibly the other lot.
Wait, before you go on from that to the game day, it's very similar to anyone who follows college recruiting as you wait on with bated breath for the signing of an 18-year-old who just wants to take his talents to Eugene, Oregon, or Norman, Oklahoma. And, you spend weeks and weeks listening to their updated list of who they're going to go to and, refreshing your browser and, like, did they sign today? Have they said they like us? Are we in their top 10? All for some 18-year-old that as soon as you sign them, they disappear for a couple of years unless they're a true transcendent superstar. Which for the most part they aren't,
and then or if they commit to Texas A&M, in which case they play immediately for a month and then have a mental breakdown because of all of the insane pressure that's put on them to win a national championship right away, and then they go to mental hospital, and then they transfer to Oklahoma and win the Heisman Trophy.
Yes, or that. Okay, so we've established that you and I are passionate about certain things. So match day comes, and what is the game day experience like for you?
Well, if we're talking about Derby, it kind of depends on the match. I mean, obviously, I live in North Carolina now. I'm on the East Coast. And most of Derby's kickoffs are a profoundly inconvenient time for a family man. I have a loving and long-suffering wife who is about as reasonable with my sports problems as any wife could possibly be. But there are limits. And so, you know, I got a wife and a child, and Derby's kickoffs are usually about 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning. And so unless I can contrive some way of convincing them that we really want to stay home on a Saturday morning, or that they want to go and do something without me, I have to expressly request, I want to watch Derby this morning, and I'm going to actually put that on the timetable. Which, unless we have an important game, if we're playing Forest or Leeds, or you know we're about to play the game in which we mathematically seal Fluffing an attempt to not make the playoffs this year, you know, it's hard to justify that sometimes. So at the moment, most Derby match days involve me trying to sneak furtive glances at a computer screen, or sneak my phone out of my pocket and not seem like I'm completely ignoring my family, because we're just playing yet another meaningless second division game in the middle of the season against some equally innocuous and forgettable team like Luton Town or Reading, which is what's happening today. We're opening the season with an away game at Reading, and really nothing is riding on this. It will have no great impact in the long history of mankind. But I managed to convince my wife and daughter that they needed to take a little trip over to Black Mountain and get some exercise and run the dog around in the park and do a few other bits and bobs that they need to do, because I had to record this podcast with you. But what I really want to do is wait until Derby kick off at 10 a.m. so I can see if we're any better than we were at the back end of last season. And I can tell you the answer right now. No. The answer is no.
So let's assume that the game is meaningful. It's Nottingham or it's Leeds. You're leading up. It's a meaningful game. And what is the feeling like? Because I'm trying to establish a baseline for who you and I are. So when I will say that when Oregon plays Washington, a lot of people say, oh, Oregon State, that's our big rival. Not really. They're terrible. We don't want to lose to them, but we rarely do. So it's not a big deal. But Washington is truly the enemy. They are the most hated and vile of people. Only vile people go to the University of Washington. And I'm assuming that only vile people cheer for Nottingham Forest. Is this correct?
Yeah, I mean, people obviously is a generous way of terming it, but I mean, vile might be a bit unfair given that they can't help it. You know, they're just born wrong, they can't do anything about it.
All right, so the game happens. It's a win. What is the experience like for you watching that match?
Well, most of it is just nerves and misery and dread. You know, every time a Forest player has the ball anywhere near the goal, but really anywhere on the field, just because Derby can find ways to throw things away in all manner of creative ways. So, you know, just nerves. A few years ago, 2017, I think, it was actually a Sunday morning, so that the match had been moved to the Sunday afternoon slot in England, such that the kickoff was something like 9 a.m. in the States. And this is always the worst then, because it means that the match is played right when we're on our way out the door to church. So I was able to watch the first half at home, and then we were going out to church. We were going to go to Sunday school before the service. And, you know, if I'm in the service, I can just about restrain myself from pulling my phone out. But, you know, if we're in Sunday school, I'm going to be able to track the scores and feel slightly more justified in sneaking furtive glances at my phone and this kind of thing. And so it's always the worst when Derby are not only playing a match, but playing an important match, when I have something else that I just can't shift. And Matic Vidra, who we later sold on, scored a goal after 90 seconds. And Forest's form had been terrible, and ours had been okay, certainly better than them, such that I felt fairly confident that if we scored first, we would go on to win, especially because we were at home. So game kicks off, ball gets tapped around a few times, works its way up the top end of the field for us. Vidra takes hold of it, just blasts it in for the top of the box. 90 seconds in, Derby are up 1-0. I'm pretty confident we're going to win, and I can leave the television screen, go to church, and basically come as close as possible to not thinking about it. That, to me, with one exception, is the ideal game between Derby and Forest, and in many ways, Derby and anyone. The exception being what I really want then is for the final whistle to go after 2 minutes. That's the dream. Is the game kicks off, Derby score, and then the game ends.
Yeah, my wife always says, why do you want Oregon to win 70-0? That seems like a really boring game. And I say to her, no, that is the most unbelievably wonderful experience I will ever get, to watch a game in which there is no doubt that the Ducks are going to win, or that West Ham is going to score 4 goals in the first half and sit on their lead, is just joyful. There is no stress in it.
Yeah, I mean, look, all the other games between all the other teams can finish, you know, 28-27. That's fantastic. But not my team. We haven't mentioned my great college football love, which is my alma mater, TCU. I was in the stadium in October 2015 when Trayvon Boykin and the Horned Frogs hung 82 on Texas Tech, who I believe had Patrick Mahomes as a freshman quarterback. I think that was his first year. 2015 was when we went up to their place and scored an incredible game-winning touchdown in the back of the end zone just about as time expired. It's 2014, we hung 82 on them at Amon G. Card Stadium in Fort Worth. And I had flown down, I was living in Michigan at the time, I flew down for the weekend, and we beat them 82 to something, 20, whatever. It doesn't really matter, does it, how many they put on the board. Trayvon Boykin just ran all over them. This was wonderful. My only regret there is that we kept it to double digits. There had to have been 20 more points in that thing somewhere that we left off the board.
I agree with you 100%. It is a glorious, glorious feeling. All right, we will get to these unbelievable moments in our sporting lives. But so we've established that putting 1,000 points on a team, whether it's 10 goals or 100 points, is far more enjoyable than the 1-0 victory or the, you know, the 13-12 victory. Those are painful. Okay, so game day, it's been stressful from the moment. Let's say you haven't been able to escape it. You're watching the match, just like we did with Derby Forest. You are a man possessed. It is painful to watch you. And I say that because that is like me. I cannot tell you how many Duck games I have not seen the end of that we've won because I have left the room because I am so angry or despondent or the other team came back. So your team, Derby, wins. What is the feeling like for you when they win?
Relief.
Not joy?
I guess it depends. Joy, definitely when we beat the teams we hate, joy. There's one of the things I love about college football, and I mean pro football is the same, but I just can't bring myself to really care about it for various reasons. But one of the things I really love about American football is the shortness of the season. In soccer, you know, there's few enough matches that each one is meaningful in the sense. It's not like baseball where they play six times a week. No one match means anything. It soccer, you know, you usually have one match a week, maybe two, but your week does kind of build up to it, and you think about it for days, and you read about, you know, injuries and who's going to be available and who the other team has missing and so on. And it does kind of give some structures your week. So it's not like it has no meaning. And of course, if you're actually able to physically attend, which is how I really fell in love with the game, it gives kind of focus to the the social structure of your week, and it's a day out, and it's special in its own right. But the season is so long that when they win, as often as not, all it makes you do emotionally is start looking at the league table and fantasizing about winning the next three on the bounce, and calculating where you'll be if you win another three or four. So it just entices you to hope, which of course is the great rock on which the emotional health and sanity of all football fans is sooner or later wrecked. And my dad said that to me many times when I was young. I have a very clear vision of him. He and I in the concourses under the upper deck in the Toyota stand, as it was then called, the old Lee stand, at the baseball ground where I grew up watching Derby before we moved at the end of the 20th century. I can see him now standing there and saying to me, "Samuel, it's not the losing that kills you. It's the hope."
That is absolutely true. It is that you play that out. You play out, like, if they win this game, all they need is a tie. I think about West Ham trying to avoid relegation last season. Right. And I kept going, well, if Villa loses here, then we're safe, and then they would win. You know, it's that constant gameplay you have in your head trying to avoid the inevitable. It's, you're right before the precipice. You're Thelma and Louise. You're going off the cliff. You see it coming, and you're like trying to think to yourself, well, if we blow a tire, if we do this, and it never happens. Inevitably, more times out of not, it's the opposite of what you think is going to happen. But yeah, that is absolutely genius.
More often than not, it's not the opposite of what you think is going to happen. It's the opposite of what you're trying to convince yourself might happen. You know, if we can just hang on to this 1-0 home win against Norwich, all we need to do is go to Old Trafford next Saturday and win 19-2, and you know, we'll survive. I think we can do it.
Yes. Oh my God. So I don't care who's listening to this. It's just anybody that's ever followed it can appreciate that. Okay. So there is a relief, a feeling, a relief. Let's skip to the loss part. Let's imagine that the game is on the line between Derby County and Forest. For whoever wins that match goes on to the Premiership, moves up out of the first division, or the second division to the first division, and Derby County loses. What is that feeling like for you?
Well, because we've done that several times here lately. I mean, we more or less lose in the playoffs every second year for the last decade. We've lost a playoff final twice in the last 6 years. In 2014. We had a bad start to the season. We were two-thirds of the way down the table at the end of October and made a change of manager, and suddenly everything clicked. So for about two-thirds of the season, we were pretty much the best team in the second division. But the start had been so bad that we just narrowly finished behind Fulham, I think, blasted Brighton in the playoff semi-finals, went on and played fourth place QPR, dominated the match. QPR had a man sent off after 30 minutes because he pulled down Johnny Russell, who was clear through on goal and would have scored. So we played for 60 minutes with a man advantage, besieged QPR's goal, could not put the thing across the line, 0-0, and with, I don't know, 30 seconds, it was the 90th minute, our talismanic captain, Richard Keogh, just made a mistake, let the ball go by him with a meadow of space in his rear, and Bobby Zamora just nipped into space, just poked it home, and QPR won a match they had no business winning. And, you know, I was watching at home. I just stormed out of the room, punched the nearest piece of furniture I could find, turned the thing off, and was fortunate enough. It's moments like those that I'm kind of glad I live in the States, in that I can then just go somewhere where nobody knows about it. Nobody knows that this thing has just happened. Nobody's miserable about it. Nobody's laughing at me. I'm not going to accidentally bump into a Forest fan in the street. But then, in some senses, it's also sad, right? Because the thing that makes spectator sports worthwhile is actually sharing it with other people. The old adage that misery loves company. You can't win all the time. You don't even win most of the time. Going and just commiserating at the pub with mates is a big part of the football culture. So in some ways it makes it worse for me actually, because I not only have, it's sort of meta, right? Because there's the immediate layer of pain, which is we lost. And then there's this weird kind of self-critical level of existential pain, which is, why are you such a ridiculous person that you care about this so much, even though nobody else around here does? And you're just making yourself miserable, and by extension, making your wife miserable. And, so in some ways it would be better to just be able to go to the pub with your mates and just, be a miserable bastard for a couple of hours over a few pints and then go home. But I shake off disappointment fairly well, I think, these days. I have very clear memories when I was young. When Derby lost the playoff final to Leicester and missed out on promotion in 1993, I was 12 years old. Maybe I'd just turned 13 a few months before, but I was old enough to know that I probably shouldn't be crying in public, but still just young enough to burst into tears. And I wept like a baby, and I just could not understand why my dad was not in pieces just crying, because the world had just collapsed on us and we weren't getting promoted and we were probably never getting promoted and nothing good was ever going to happen to Derby in our entire lives and so on. Of course, my dad had just 18 years previously seen Derby win the league for the second time in 5 years, which, 18 years felt like an eternity to me at that age. But, now I understand, it's probably, he's seen good times and bad times, and they kind of roll into each other. You can't let yourself right. get too far up, and you can't let yourself get too far down. In fact, the morning after that loss in the playoff final, I was sitting at breakfast with my wife, and I was literally physically hanging my head into my breakfast bowl. I was sitting there with my nose about 3 inches from the milk in my breakfast cereal, just feeling miserable. And my wife said to me, "Why do you do this to yourself?" And I didn't even hesitate. I said, "Because of the Rose Bowl." Which, of course, that's conflating two sports, but that's what we're doing here, right? Our two great loved sports. Like, I will never forget the 2 second play in which TCU sealed that win in the Rose Bowl. And I'll probably never see them in the Rose Bowl again. I'll probably never see them win the Rose Bowl again, but they did win it. And I was there, and it was amazing.
Yeah. It's like when the Giants, San Francisco Giants, finally won a World Series in 20. I mean, they won two more after that, but I've never forgotten that feeling of relief. Like, okay, we finally did it. I don't care if we ever win again. We finally did it. That's the way I feel about the Oregon Ducks missing out on the national championship. I think if they won, I think there's something about people like you and me that get so passionate about it that it's just a relief.
Right.
That it's like finally over. And like you said, your dad could hang his hat on an 18-year-old. I want to do this because I want to talk about how you became a Derby fan and how you became a TCU fan. So let's start by talking about, how did you become a Derby County football fan?
Well, that one's easy. I was just born.
You're not from Derby County. You live closer to Nottingham Forest, didn't you?
Well, I mean, I grew up on the Derby Road. I live just on the Nottingham side of the county line. Stapleford is my mother's home village, and my dad grew up in Long Eaton, which is on the Derbyshire side of the line from Stapleford. So there's a cluster of towns there in the Erewash Valley, and the Erewash Valley is between Nottingham and Derby, which are 16 miles apart, which in American terms is no distance at all. In English terms, that's far enough to make two distinct communities. You know, if there were two people in a room and one of them was born and bred Nottingham boy and one was a born and bred Derby boy, you could ask them to say one sentence each and I could tell you which one was which. You know, that's how big of a difference 16 miles make. And I grew up on the road between those two towns. I was born at a time when Forest were truly great. The road, the highway that connects Nottingham and Derby has since been renamed the Brian Clough Way for Brian Clough, who is the greatest manager in the history of English football. He won the league with Derby, fell out with the chairman, resigned, very famously went to Leeds. There's a great movie about that you and I need to sit down and watch together. Lasted 44 days at Leeds, spent a year or two at Brighton, then went to Forest, won the league and the European Cup twice at Forest. The second time was 1981, and I was born the next year. So I was born into a county, Nottinghamshire, just by about a mile, in which the hated Nottingham Forest Football Club had, within the past year, won their second European Cup consecutively. And they were as big and as great as it was possible to get. And so I grew up with boys at school who were accustomed to Nottingham Forest being great and Derby being an absolute disaster. We were almost liquidated in 1984. We almost went into administration and were booted from the league because we had massive unpaid debts to Her Majesty's revenue. We were saved by some last minute investment. And so it was dire times when I was small.
Can you explain what it means to have a football club? I love what you said about the 16-mile difference. I think that we're such a regional nation. We some people root for their local community or their local college or their, you know, their city. Their, I guess Charlotte would be the closest thing we would do to Charlotte, Carolina Panthers or whatever. But it's different in England. It's the clubs have a different meaning. Can you explain that a little bit as far as what that looks like? Because it's not just like there's like 10 big clubs or 28 right. football teams. There are hundreds of these yeah. teams. So in each town basically has one. Can you explain?
Yeah. It's the geography of the game has changed as the economic and human geography of England has changed. In some ways for the better, in some ways for the worse. Although I'm going to put an asterisk next to the worst because there's and I'm not going to apologize for it. I'm just going to tell you up front. Anytime I talk about old timey English football, it's with a self-conscious degree of nostalgia. I grew up going to watch Derby in old grounds or stadiums, as Americans would say, that were decaying, decrepit, had never been fancy even when they were new and were now 100 years old. And let me put it this way. I've weed in some pretty nasty toilets in my time as a Derby fan. I remember one time at the Oakwell Ground, Barnsley, just standing shoulder to shoulder at halftime with a just crowd of Derby fans, just weeing into a just tin trough that wasn't draining properly. It was just a huge tin trough that was just already full of gallons and gallons of hot wee that wasn't going anywhere. And, it, you know, that's what football was like when I was young. Just tin troughs full of warm piss. Literally and metaphorically. West Ham, your club, recently moved from Upton Park, which was a venerable old ground of the English style, which I've been to, and I can't even remember the final score, which probably means I saw Derby lose there, into, what do they call it, the City of London Stadium or Olympic Stadium?
Yeah, Olympic Stadium.
It's amazing. Plush, beautiful. But the quintessential old style English stadium, Americans would best think of Fenway Park or Wrigley Field. Those are really the only two true equivalents on the American level. And every baseball club used to be the same. surrounded by terraced houses and city narrow city streets. You aren't even on match day. You wouldn't even be allowed to park your car on the street within about a mile of the ground because it would just clog everything up. So you have to, if you drive, you have to park a few miles away, and or you'd have to get the train to the station and then walk from the train station. And you wouldn't be able to see the stadiums from where you parked because they would be surrounded by these terraced houses, which, let's see what the American term would be, townhomes or row homes, just row after row. Leicester, like most of these clubs now, including Derby, have moved away from their old stadium like that into a development that's just a few miles away on what geographers refer to as a brownfield site, you know, a new build just outside of the kind of working class housing districts. But their old ground, Filbert Street, the entrance, the turnstile to get into the away section used to be a house. Like you walked into the stadium literally through a house. Now, not one that someone lived in, but it was, you walk up the street and it's house that someone lives in, house that someone lives in, house that someone lives in, gate to get into the stadium with a house around it. It used to be a house and they just bought the house, and you walk in and give your ticket and go through the turnstile. And then on the back side of the house, you're in the concourse under the stand. You know, buy a cup of tea or a beer or whatever and walk up some steps and bam, you're in a football stadium. And there's just people living all the way around this field that can squeeze about 30,000 people around it cheek by jowl. And you get to the stadium, you know, you park a few miles away, you come out of the train station and you can't see the stadium. You can just see these old style floodlights on this kind of scaffolding, right? You've seen the pictures probably, or you probably, I know that you remember it from the old Upton Park. They used to put the floodlights on at the four corners of the stadiums on these great scaffolds that looked like electricity pylons. And so you can, especially if it's dark. Yeah. So in winter, because the kickoff would be 3 p.m. on a Saturday afternoon. And in winter in England, it's dark by about 4:30. And it's not really light ever. And so the lights would be on even before the match kicked off. So you would get in the general neighborhood of the stadium maybe 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 2:30, and you'd be walking from the pub or the train station or the place where you parked your car or the chip shop. And you could see these lights about a mile or 2 miles away. And you just sort of, especially if it's an away ground and you don't actually know the streets. I could walk from where me and my dad parked to the old baseball ground blindfolded. But you're going to an away ground you've never been to before, you've only been a couple of times. You don't need directions. You just need to park close enough to see the floodlights. And you just walk toward them like a literal pilgrim, right? Like you're on your way to Mecca. I'm probably going to get fatwa for that.
Most likely.
You're on your way to some politically correct analogy of a pilgrimage site, and you just sort of everyone and the people come together like rivulets running into a stream. It starts with just you and the people you came with, and then you fall in with another couple, and they fall in with it. And by the time you get to the ground, you know there's you know a few dozen of you pooling into crowds of 100 going in together. And then you come up the steps into the stadium, and it's you and, you know, 4,000 of your best mates there, ready to cheer for some complete futility show for a couple of hours.
Well, the funny thing about that is I could not agree with you more about the parks. You know, it's funny, America went to these multi-use sites.
Yeah.
And they were horrible. They were like the old Houston Astros stadium. And now they've kind of gone back to, it started in Baltimore, and they've built, if you look at Pac Bell Park, I still call it Pac Bell. I think they call it something else now in San Francisco, but they're beautiful. And I think that's the mistake that English football is making, is that Upton Park was, yes, it was in the middle of a neighborhood, and it was old, and it was, you know, you couldn't, I think it only fit 19,000, and Olympic Stadium fits 60, but there's something about that closeness, cheek to jowl, as you said, that makes it so much of a great viewing experience. Whereas when you go to these giant stadiums, it's just not. I hate going to NFL stadiums because they're big, they're impersonal. It's all about Wrigley Field now has completely redone itself. It was the closest thing you would get to what you were talking about. Going, you just walk through the streets and all of a sudden the stadium appears in front of you. It's like crazy.
Right.
Now they've got big, huge, you know, giant TV screens and all this. It's just, like you said, there's a part of me that's nostalgic. I get why they did it, because it's easier for people and those old stadiums. So I completely agree with you about that. So you grow up watching, or you're born into it. Your dad is a Derby fan. You grow up watching it. Is it just part of your life from the time you can remember?
Yeah, well, I remember being really small, 5, 6, and around about lunchtime, a little after lunch on a Saturday afternoon, my dad would disappear to the football. And my dad was a lawyer and thoroughly unathletic. I don't know if you've ever seen me attempt to do anything athletic, but you know what I look like. Frisbee golf. Yeah, that's about as athletic as I get. My dad, he never wore trainers or sneakers or tennis shoes or whatever, except on a Saturday afternoon, he would put his white tennis shoes on and disappear to the match. And I can visualize him in the kitchen with his old sort of English style, completely crappy Dunlop sports bag, which was just a faux leather bag with a zip, and he pulls out his white shoes and puts them on and goes off to the football. And in my mind, I thought he was going off to play, which, as I got older and got to know him, seemed ridiculous to imagine him even attempting to play football. We played some cricket when we were young. We had a church league cricket team that was about as athletic as we got. And if you've ever seen cricket, you know
I love cricket.
It's a great game, but you can be obscenely fat and absolutely 0% fit and be a very good cricketer. That's one of the many reasons why it's God's game. You don't actually have to be a sportsman to play it. So he would disappear to the match, and in my mind, I thought that that he was going off to play, but I didn't go to a match with him until I was 8. I went to see Derby for the first time in April of 1990, which was a few months after I turned 8. I think I would have gone earlier in the year, but about exactly a calendar year before that had been the Hillsborough disaster. Which is really the turning point in the history of the English game.
Yeah,
it's kind of like the BC AD marker of when the English game went from grimy, gritty, underfunded, violent to the sort of plush, modern spectacle that Americans are accustomed to. And you're an interesting case, Brandon, because you are one of many tens of millions of Americans. When I moved here 17 years ago to the States, no one was watching English football. It was a very niche thing to do, to watch the Premier League, if you could even find it, because it wasn't on television.
Right.
And now there are tens of millions of Americans watching the Premier League every Saturday. People come up to me and want to talk about football everywhere I go, and they always know more than I do, because I don't watch that much Premier League football, because it just depresses me because Derby aren't in it. And you know way more about the Premier League than I do at this point in time.
All right, so you grow up in this. Your dad goes off to games. Your dad is a football fan. I'm assuming that most of your friends around you are football fans.
Yes, although not Derby fans, because I went to school in Nottinghamshire, and at the time Derby were pretty rubbish, and Forest were fairly great. And so I grew up in that territory where, and you were asking about this a few minutes ago, and I started talking about the grounds more than kind of the human geography. But England is about the size of the state of Georgia and has a population of about 50 million people. London is the great metropole, and Birmingham the second. Manchester's fairly big as well. There are small cities everywhere. You don't just drive like you do in the States for hour upon hour through mostly rural territory with small towns at most, if not just nothing. You know, you can't drive in any direction for more than about half an hour before you're going to hit a decent sized city. So it's an urban country with a fairly dense population. And in the Victorian era, the latter part of the 19th century, when urbanization was, you know, kind of a concluding process. England had been urbanizing for about 100 years previously. And, you know, the urban geography of England now and the urban geography of England in the late Victorian period is roughly the same, kind of where the centers of population are, where people live, in what numbers they live there. It's about the same. The cities are less grimy, and lots of other things have changed, primarily what people do for a living, right? The factories and the dockyards and the coal mines are gone. But the cities are still there. And in the days when the working men were in the factories and they were in the dockyards and the shipyards and the coal mines, these clubs started as in the same way. In fact, actually, first they, English reformers, urban progressive reformers, emulated America by trying to bring baseball over. And in the late 1870s and 80s, there was a fairly thriving baseball league in England that was sponsored by factory owners who wanted to give their employees some exercise and an outlet to either play a sport or watch a sport. And I grew up, I mentioned it a few minutes ago, I grew up watching Derby play in their original stadium where we played for a century that was called the baseball ground, because it was behind the Lee factory that Mr. Lee purchased this field and sponsored the Derby baseball club. And when baseball in England died in the later 1880s as this new game, association football, choked it out in terms of popularity, the baseball league gave way to the new football league, and Derby County moved from the county cricket ground to purchase and occupy this old baseball field. And they built the stadium there, and it was just always called the baseball ground. So I grew up watching English soccer in a sports field whose origin was this American game that no one cared about. It was just the baseball ground. The geography of football allegiance is one of urban community. You cheered for the team that was in your town, and they probably played just about three streets away from your front door. You know, you open the door, walk out, down a few streets, take a few turns, and boom, you know, you'd be there at the stadium, because that's where the fields were. They put the fields near where all the working class people who were the target audience for the club for people to play and participate and watch. And so these communities kind of grow up around these clubs, and every little town or district of a town, if the town is big enough, they have two. And one of the good things about Derby is we're small enough town to only have one team. Derby is a real football town. Everyone in Derby just loves Derby County Football Club. And they don't cheer for anyone else because there isn't any. Well, they didn't used to until the television age. Now you get little boys going to Derby matches wearing Man United shirts, but that's something else entirely. You cheered for the team in your town. Allegiances are very local. Our rivals, Forest, you cross the Trent River and Notts County's ground, Meadow Lane. Those are the two closest stadiums to each other in England. I think they're maybe separated by about 1,000 yards. You can see one from the other. You think of say Shea Stadium from Yankee Stadium. I guess they don't play in Shea anymore, do they? The Mets, what is it? No. Citibank, of course.
Yeah, it's some very new modern stadium.
Taxpayer bailout stadium. you know, it can be like Everton and Liverpool, right? They're just across Stanley Park from each other. You know, Goodison, you can walk from Goodison to Anfield in about 10 minutes, I think.
I don't think most people in America can really appreciate that, even in cities like San Francisco that had the Raiders across the way. It was still an hour away. But the fact that you can have like Everton and Liverpool be so close, but yet so, I mean, if you're an Everton fan, you are definitely not a Liverpool fan.
Right.
That's just not the way it's going to be. And so I just don't think in America, mostly they're regionally set teams like the Carolina Panthers or the Seattle Seahawks.
Yeah.
You don't have a team, you know, rarely, even in LA where you have, you know, teams, it doesn't feel like it's just so much bigger that you just have, you don't have these crossbreeding populations of people that are so fervent about their, you know, their violent in their passion for their teams.
Yeah, now I fell in love with college football for largely the reason that it's the closest thing in America to that. And you can speak to whether it's the same in the old, you know, Pac-10, Pac-8, which I think it probably is. But down in SWC country, the old Southwest Conference in Texas, which is now defunct and has been largely absorbed by the Big 12. But, you know, you go to a game between two of the great Texas football schools. You know, I would go down to Austin to watch TCU or Baylor, or, you know, I went once to see Tech play TCU in Austin. And you see these groups of people tailgating together in which they're maybe mostly for the one team, but you know, you'll have a bunch of Texas people and there'll be some Baylor people sprinkled in. Or, you know, I go down to Waco to see the Frogs and there are mixed groups of TCU Baylor people. And I went to a game once down there with a friend of mine who was a Baylor grad. You know, you have that that kind of community overlap because, say, you know, you might grow up cheering for Texas, but then you end up going to school at Baylor.
Right.
So you do have it. It's different because it's not geographic as such. It's partly geographic. It's partly personal. But you do have these communities of identity that are adjacent to one another, that kind of rub up against one another in a way that's intense and sort of exciting, and might say perhaps inciting, right? You know, Thanksgiving dinner is always going to be fun, or it's going to be miserable if you lose in the truly urban districts of these old American football or baseball towns. I mean, if you grew up working class in Southie, going to watch baseball at Fenway Park whenever you could scrape together a nickel to get on the bleachers, you know, that truly is part of your identity. But if it's just, you're just some bourgeois person from the central Massachusetts hinterland who drives in a couple of weekends a year, it's not the same thing. Yeah, I mean, you're right about college and travel and that experience. About let me read you a little something. You've probably read this book, very famous football book, Nick Hornby, Fever Pitch. You read that?
Mm-mm. No.
I mean, he's an Arsenal fan, so you wouldn't enjoy it entirely.
The Gunner.
It's probably, as I think, the most widely read and famous influential football book ever written in England, written in the early 90s. He was a novelist, quite a respected novelist, and the book was something of a confession, kind of confession of a bourgeois literati soccer fan at a time when it wasn't trendy to be a soccer fan. It is now. You know, you'd see Prince William at Villa matches or whatever. I don't know what his bloody problem is.
Yeah, but I don't understand that connection, but he must have been a castle near there or something.
Right. Yeah, exactly. The only good thing about Villa are the colours they wear, right? In this one chapter, he's talking actually about, I like the chapter particularly because he's talking about going to Derby when Charlie George was at the height of his greatness for Arsenal, and Derby was still a very, very good team, and my dad would have been at this match. He said, at our destination, we were met by hundreds and hundreds of police, So they're just getting off the train at the train station, going on one of these old football specials, which are just crappy trains that the fans used to just tear to pieces, who were then escorted us to the ground by a circuitous route away from the city centre. It was during these walks that my urban hooligan fantasies were given free rein. I was completely safe, protected not only by the law, but by my fellow supporters. And I had therefore been liberated to allow in my still unbroken voice, to bellow along in my still unbroken voice with the chanted threats of the others. I didn't look terribly hard, in truth. I was as yet nowhere near as big as I should have been and wore black-framed, brain-style National Health reading glasses, although these I hid away for the duration of the route marches, presumably to make myself just that little bit more terrifying. But those who mumble about the loss of identity football fans must endure miss the point. The loss of identity can be a paradoxically enriching process. Who wants to be stuck with who they are the whole time? I, for one, wanted time out from being a jug-eared, bespectacled suburban twerp once in a while. I loved being able to frighten the shoppers in Derby or Norwich or Southampton, and they were frightened. You could see it. My opportunities for intimidating people had been limited hitherto, though I knew it wasn't me that made the people hurry to the other side of the road, hauling their children after them. It was us, and I was part of us, an organ in the hooligan body. The fact that I was an appendix, small, useless, hidden, out of the way, somewhere in the middle, didn't matter in the slightest. And you know, that's the thing about traveling. It's the home matches are great. You know, right. You love the ground. It's your town. It's your community. You have your rituals. You eat the same thing. You park in the same place. You walk the same route. You see the same people. You sit in the same seats around the same season ticket holders. That's great. But the best thing is going with that small crowd of hardcore nutters who are so stupidly obsessed with this pointless thing that they'll spend all the money they have, and probably a bit more than that, traveling to the other end of the country on a Saturday afternoon when they probably ought to be doing something better, just to go to an equally crappy ground to watch some equally crappy club and cheer for your team somewhere else, just so you can show your face and you know, be seen. And say, we're here, Derby boys, we are here. You know, come on, you Rams. F you to the other lot. You know, hopefully snatch a win. And the wins are always better on the road.
Yes.
It always feels better to win on the road. To stand in a stadium with, you know, 3,000 of your best mates cheering when 25,000 people in front of you are miserable, and especially if they're miserable and heading for the exits, you know, chanting cheerio and waving as they head out the door to go home early because you've just, you know, your lot have just sealed it. As long as you don't get your head punched in on the way home, which doesn't happen these days very much and hasn't ever happened to me, thank God. Nothing feels better.
Because that very idea, talking about the road versus the home and the feeling of fans. So you were born into being a football fan, but how do you become a college football fan? You grow up a Derby County fan, you know everything about the sport, you're passionate about it, but how do you become a college fan, football fan?
Yeah, well, I'll give you the shortest version I can. It was the fall of 2003. I'd been in the States for about 6 weeks. I was already a football fan. I used to watch the pros with an American roommate of mine in England back when no one in England was watching the NFL. I had to get up in the middle of the night because there's no DVRs right. back in those days. I had to get up in the middle of the night and watch it on an obscure channel. And I owned it. My friend was a diehard Niners fan. So I knew the rules of the game and I loved the game, cheered for the game on the professional level, but didn't really know anything about college football. But I moved to Atlanta to start grad school and had a friend whose hometown was Tuscaloosa. And he had, he was kind of an Anglophile, still is really. He'd spent his junior year of high school on exchange in my hometown, decided that he wanted to spend a year in England and wanted to go to the real England. And so he ended up in Long Eaton, which is about real England as you can get. No ordinary American would just decide I'm going to go to Long Eaton. You know, it would be a bit like saying, you know, I want to go to the States. I really want to get to know American culture. I need to spend a year of the flower of my youth in Akron. That's the place for me.
No. Yeah.
Yeah.
I gotcha.
I'm going to Bakersfield.
Yes.
Exactly. So long. So long, mother. So long, father. I'm off to Bakersfield, CA. So he ends up in Long Eaton and ends up living with a family in my church and got to know him pretty well. I hadn't seen him for about 5 years, but I emailed him and said, "Hey, you know, I'm going out to Atlanta to grad school." And he said, "Oh man, you know, we'll have to get together." He was in his senior year at the University of Alabama, and he was vice president of the ATO fraternity there. And he said, "I'll drive out, pick you up, drive you back to Tuscaloosa." So he drives me from Atlanta to Tuscaloosa, which is about a 3-hour drive. And all the way he gives, now this is 2003. Alabama had just fired Mike Price with an all-time record as Alabama head coach of 0-0 for having been seen in a strip club, which is so funny because how many strip clubs do you think? I mean, Nick Saban at this point could be seen in a gay bar putting $5 bills in a young man's skimpy negligee, and he'd probably get a raise for it, right? And this is the University of Alabama. Like you know, they were in the pits right then, and people were saying, you know, Alabama fans are stuck in the past. They're unrealistic. They'll never be good again. They think they should be winning championships, but Bear Bryant's not coming back from the dead, et cetera, et cetera. And he spent the whole journey just giving me kind of the back history of Alabama football, and his dad was the college roommate and lifelong best friend. My friend is now married and has you know whole family with the daughter of his father's college roommate. This guy is kind of Alabama famous. My friend's father-in-law. He sells paintings of great moments in Alabama football history. And if you know a real diehard Alabama fan, the chances that they've got one of this guy's paintings framed on the wall in their house is very, very high. Moore, M-O-O-R-E is the last name. I forget his first name, but if you just Google Moore Alabama football paintings, it'll come up. Alabama football is in the DNA of my friend's family, and he's Tuscaloosa born and bred. And you know, back then, Alabama wasn't the juggernaut that they had been or are now. They were themselves kind of in the wilderness, nearly men. I just kind of was hooked on these stories of this once great, now somewhat out of fortune program with this great history. And I remember coming up the highway. We drove along I-20 and then turned off whatever US highway it is that connects I-20 to Tuscaloosa, this 4-lane highway, and it goes up a rise, and Tuscaloosa is kind of in a valley on the far side of this rise, and you come down the backside of this rise toward the town, and it's just a classic college town. It's not that big. You can see the whole of it in one go, and then there's just this spaceship, this enormous spaceship of a stadium that dominate, growing up in England, where there aren't that many huge stadiums, and if there are, they're in big urban areas, right? Like a small town like Swindon doesn't just have Old Trafford sitting in the middle of it. And if it did, it would look ridiculous.
Yeah.
But that's what college towns are like. You just get these little towns of like 80,000 people with
25,000, like Corvallis, Oregon is 25,000 people.
Right. And you can probably get, what, 55,000 people in their football stadium.
Oh, yeah.
So the stadium is twice the size of the town. Right. I mean, that is insane and amazing and wonderful. And we just drove toward this town and bam, there's this enormous thing. It's like, yep, there's the stadium. And I was like, I'm in.
Well, and that campus, it's a it's a campus stadium. So it's one great thing I love about college football is that most of the stadiums are not these weird stadiums that are off in the middle of nowhere. Most of them are on campus. So
right. You
walk through campus and it's similar to walking through the streets of these English football towns.
Yeah. Anytime I'm in a college town, I will go by and look at the football stadium. When it comes to soccer, you know, I'll watch other soccer teams, but it's really just about my obsession with Derby for me. College football, I'll watch just about any team play any team anywhere. It's the spectacle is amazing, but that's how I fell in love with football.
Well, we have run very long, Sam, but I love talking with you about football and football, and I'm very excited to continue to do so in our upcoming podcast, Football and Football. If people are interested, they can look us up. We'll be on all the pods. If you have any questions for me, please email me at imjpodcast@gmail.com, and I will answer any of your questions. If you have ideas for guests or just questions in general for me, please email me there. Otherwise, thank you so much for listening.
So I opened the door and I slid in slow, grabbed some tapes, took out the stereo, Nick took the radar off of the dash, and the glove box bin found $100 cash. Then I saw flicker inside the front door. Tom DeLoach pulled out his 44, said, "Who the hell's breaking into my 40?"